welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We're glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming in the second half of today's show, it's Prairie Plates. Today we're talking food trucks, and we'll have another edition of Prairie Beat, which will mirror the discussion we're having in the first part of the show, and that's about the political violence this past weekend in Minnesota. Welcome to Main Street on this Wednesday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. On June 14th, 57-year-old Vance Bolter, a self-described conservative disguised in police gear, is alleged to have carried out unconscionable politically motivated attacks in Minnesota, fatally shooting former House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband, and wounding State Senator John Hoffman and his wife. Authorities apprehended Bolter after the largest manhunt in state history. He's been charged with multiple counts of murder and attempted murder, and allegedly kept a manifesto with a list of over 70 political targets. Joining me to discuss is Merrill Pepcorn, a long-serving, now retired member of the North Dakota legislature, who also ran for governor of the state last year. I've invited Merrill to discuss the meaning of public service, the challenges of political discourse today, and how leaders can respond to rising threats like the recent political violence in Minnesota. Merrill, I wish we were talking about something else.
Well, that's a lot to chew on that you just mentioned there, Craig, but I'm happy to be along and talk about it with you today.
In this moment of political and social tension, what does public service mean to you, having looked back in your career and recognizing what's transpired?
First of all, the meaning of public service and serving in the state legislature changed for me after being elected. I think a lot of people in the public think it's kind of a cush job. You know, you get elected, you get paid, it's a part-time job, you show up, you work 4 months out of the year. One of the benefits is really good life insurance from the, health insurance from the state. That's important to a lot of people, it was to me. And you really don't have to do much. You show up for those 4 months and that's a kind of a cushy deal. And it is not that way. Legislators, I've pondered, you know, Minnesota has a full-time legislature. You're compensated for full-time work. And it's been considered in North Dakota. It could be a full-time job, I think, in North Dakota. A North Dakota legislator does not have any staff. We don't have a private office. Our staff is our desk in the chamber. And the interim, it all depends on the individual. And the people that I worked with in my Dem NPL party really are focused on serving their constituents. And that means a lot of contact in the interim, in between sessions, and working for people, attending a lot of committee meetings, and just really working at your job full time. So that citizen legislature thing, that changed for me. I realized really what a time consuming job it was. And that was just made it more important to me. Public servant in this case, I think it's a good word for it, because most people who run for office and want to be in that position are there to serve. I will say that.
You and I have talked previously about the tone of political discourse. Merrill, what's different today than when you started serving a few years ago?
In the legislature, well, it is more evident, I believe, in the House of Representatives, in the House, which has 94 members, than it is in the Senate, the state North Dakota State Senate, which has 47 members. The conversation is more polite. It's more congenial. This is nothing new. I think it's maybe been going on for longer than I think, just because of the numbers. The more people you got, the more discussion, the more viewpoints you have. But nobody's been kicked out of the Senate by their colleagues, and there have been people expelled from the House for their actions, for their attitude, for their language. And I think it's not getting any better.
Moving forward, do you think it will be more difficult for North Dakotans to access their political leaders because of concerns of personal safety?
Well, I just heard on the news today that the head of legislative council, John Bjornson, who has been there, talk about a public servant. There are not many people more important to how government runs in North Dakota than John Bjornson with with the legislative council. But he took it upon himself to remove addresses of the individual legislators, state senators, and representatives. Myself, but it's voluntary in the first place. I always put my personal phone number on there and my personal email, because then I pay more attention to it than if it comes to my government email, for one thing. So just the fact that your address is removed, they can still send you a note to the Capitol. You'll get it eventually, even if the legislature isn't in session, you'll get that note. But if even that small act of removing your name from the website with information about your legislators, with that gone, that makes it a little bit more difficult. So I don't think it's ever going to swing back. Will be easier access to your legislators. On the other hand, the people that I work with make it a point to become available to the people in their districts.
What about casting that very difficult vote? When you know you're in a minority perhaps, maybe a principled vote, you know that both sides are hot about the issue, is that going to be harder for people to do in the future?
Well, let's take, of course, one of the, and maybe the hottest hot button issue, and that is abortion, access to abortion, a woman's right to choose, however you want to state it. And that representative was the speaker in the House, and she was a pro-choice person. She had a deciding vote in the big budget bill, which was not directly related to any budget thing, but there, she was in a pickle there. Because, you know, if anybody was upset with her about that vote, it would be people from her own party. So this assassination had nothing to do with her single vote. But, you know, that it's odd, that ironic maybe, that here we're talking about an instance where her vote did make that difference, and she voted against her party just to move what she thought would be the best for the state. So isn't it ironic then that just days later, she was assassinated because of an issue totally unrelated to that. But
back to my question,
that's a toughie.
Will it be harder for some to cast these tough votes now?
I would like to think it wouldn't affect me, but I'm not in office anymore. I don't intend to run for office again. And I think most people, again, I keep saying that I know, are going to vote their conscience or on behalf of their constituents and the fact that it's, tough, hold your finger up in the air, you'll see which way the wind's blowing. I don't think that's going to be necessarily a big factor.
Do you think this current political climate has already discouraged good people from stepping into these leadership roles?
Yes. Not only leadership roles, running for office in general, and then how about leadership within the party once you get to Bismarck or whatever, form chairmanship of the party, so on and so forth. You know, it's really funny what I've noticed in my District 44 in North Fargo. For years, I think 18 years, it had elected two Republican representatives in the House and one Republican senator for 18 years. So it was all Republican, and the Dem NPLers. I always mention NPL, that nonpartisan league in North Dakota, is important to me. But the Dem NPL party sometimes couldn't even field an entire roster of candidates, maybe one or two, sometimes a full roster. So, but that says to me that people, if they're not assured of being elected, it's tough to go out there and be the what's known as the sacrificial lamb. So now that the MNPLers have been elected by a fairly sizable margin in each of the past three elections, this last election, there was no opposition from the Republicans in District 44. So to me, it's like people are wimpy in the first place, but this will not make things any easier. It's like, who will want to serve and put themselves in this position under this public scrutiny by a potential wacko? Although, but the thing is, we will say, well, that can't happen here. We don't want to be the place, the state, where something tragic does happen. We could take some measures to help prevent it, and it happens, and then just say, we never thought that could happen here. What are those measures? They're going to be worked on. In fact, legislative management will work next week with our paid government officials in those offices, with security, and figure some of those things out. So we have to take some steps to ramp up security. There's just no doubt about it, because things are not going to go back the other way.
What should voters tell national leaders, state leaders, county leaders, how to model themselves and have respectful disagreement when our environment is becoming more polarized?
I have neighbors in North Fargo with whom I have political differences, and we have a great relationship as neighbors. I put it like this: if we were threatened, if my block was threatened by some ominous outside force that was coming in to take over our block, we would stand together. Our neighborhood would stand together because we believe in each other as people. So I think that we can have those discussions and not be so polarized as to shut out other ideas, even if they seem so completely off the wall that you could never, it could never swallow them, you can at least talk about it. Or else you just avoid it completely. Don't talk about it.
Well, that leads to this question, Merrill. Yeah. People have coworkers. We have family members where we feel we can't have a politically related discussion. What can change to allow that to happen?
Well, I don't know if it's always been this way, but you know, I think our country's leadership, the President of the United States, has helped foster this atmosphere, this environment of not being able to talk, but of conflict. And not that he is directing that to happen, but he is, by pardoning, for example, by pardoning all the, call them what you want, the insurrectionists, the demonstrators, the tourists, some people call the people who were involved in that, some people call them rioters.
You're talking about January 6th.
January 6th. By pardoning all of those people that went through the legal system, were found guilty, they were sentenced to a certain time in prison or other penalties, by pardoning all of those people, it says to me that he, our president, has given permission to act how they want. And without directly saying, all right, go out there and go get them. But by creating that atmosphere, by creating that environment, that is not helping. And I think he is emboldening people, perhaps like this person who took things into his own hands by murdering the legislators in Minnesota.
We're enjoying our discussion with Merrill Pepcorn, a long-serving, now retired member of the North Dakota legislature and also a gubernatorial candidate in the state of North Dakota. We're talking about what it means to serve the public, the challenges of political discourse today, and how leaders can respond to rising threats like the political violence last weekend in Minnesota. Merrill, what did you think about when you heard what happened Sunday morning?
It was tough, of course. I think somebody would really have to be off the rails to be or ignorant of things that are going on of life to just ignore it and go, oh, well, it happens, or to even celebrate. I suppose those people are out there. But for me, you know, I just talked about, you know, we don't want something to happen, and then but we never thought that could happen here. It could happen here. So it's sad. But, you know, like your guest, Bob, or Rev, as he prefers to be called.
He was a guest we had on Main Street earlier this week. He'll be honored this weekend in Minot, 97-year-old.
Yes. What a guy. What a man whose life was devoted to service, to hope.
Social justice.
When he indicated that, you know, he was not like, hey, everything's going to be all right. When he's been through the civil rights movement, through a lot in his, well, 97 years old, in his 85 years of maybe so involvement, you know, started as a young man, he's seen a lot. And this is probably as dark as he has seen it. I just didn't know what to think. It's like, how can this happen?
So and, is there, Merrill, a path forward? People talk about healing, bridging divides in our communities, where political violence and uncivil discourse is the norm. I'm worried, though.
Correct. I'm not worried to the point of staying, keeping me up late at night. But, I mean, I think about it. You can't help but think about it. You know, if you read news or if you're out living and talking to people. But I do believe that it's not getting better. The extremists, I will use the word, I don't think conservative is a fair word to use in talking about politics, conservative and liberal. I think extremists...
Who are on both sides.
Both sides, mm-hmm. Becoming more extreme, but most of us are still in the middle. I have a little company, and we got a band called the Radio Stars Band, and our mission is, I have a mission statement for our little band and for other things, films we do and so on and so forth. So our mission generally is to bring joy into people's lives, lifting their spirits wherever we go. And I think that, just for me personally, professionally, and personally, is my goal, not to be looking to criticize, but looking for the good. And I'm not capable of doing that all the time. That's my goal. And I would hope that others who are better at that than I am, if we could all just kind of bundle up our energy and send it off in the right direction, that, you know, we can overcome this this tension and conflict and divisive forces that are happening today.
But I have a feeling young people aren't as involved, maybe then not as concerned about things politically in our world today because of the chaos. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that could be. I wasn't particularly engaged myself at that age, but for my one son, we have one son and his wife, They have a 5 and a 2-year-old daughters. They're engaged. I wish them well. I trust the generation that's coming on behind us to educate and to raise their children to appreciate who we are, where we are, respect each other, be involved, to do the right thing. So it's not going to be easy, but I trust them to stay true to the course. So it's going to be it's their job, basically, at this point. Although you and I aren't going to be dropping out, but those are the people that are going to be stepping in, and I trust them. Yeah.
Merrill, you and I agreed to visit about this topic today.
Yeah.
And you brought a Bible with you.
Yeah, I did.
Why?
Well, because there are a couple of things. You know, my church family is important to me. It's the people, the relationship. I have a relationship with my God that grows by attending church. I participate in my church service by doing some liturgy and singing. You know, I do a lot of my spiritual connecting through music, either singing in church or some spiritual type songs or things that aren't necessarily religious, but just, you know, have a lot of meaning about life and caring about people. But at any rate, I got this retired men's Bible study group, which is, you know, they're a blast. I get strength from sitting around this table with pretty much retired men and talking about things and how we're affected each day by and how we affect others. And I come away just a better person by being in church, by being with these men. But there are a couple of things in the Bible that have stood out to me. You know, there's always, well, religion, you know, what about this, and what about that? And I just can't deny this. Well, so I'm looking for good things in my religion that I like. And I come into this verse, and I hate it when people pick out verses. Well, it says in the Bible, you know, this chapter and this verse, and then that gives you permission to do whatever you want. But in the book of Micah in the Old Testament, it says, "And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?" That's it. To me, that's it. That's all. And just one more little biblical thing here, and it's called the most important commandment of all. It's not like the 1 through 10 commandments, but it's when Jesus was being, you know, battered with questions by his detractors, you know, and they go, "Well, what commandment is the first of all?" He goes, "The first is, the Lord is our God. The Lord is the one. You shall love your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, followed by, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself." And that's awfully hard. It's awfully hard sometimes. Not just for me to love those neighbors that are politically different than I am, but for them to love me. And I think, you know, we can do that. We can reach down in our hearts and do that.
You check back in your life 30, 40 years ago, Merrill, are you still gonna run for political office if the environment were as it is today?
Maybe, you know.
You're not sure?
No. I have always been connected to, I've always been interested in government and state government, and the time in my life was right for me to run when I did. I'm proud of my service there. One thing I did by not running for my Senate seat, which I would have run unopposed, and by running for governor, which I thought I had a chance to win, or I wouldn't have entered the, well, look up the results and think I was crazy. But as I stepped aside, it made room for a younger person from my district to step into that role. And therefore we have someone from a younger generation stepping in and taking some leadership there. So I'm comfortable with that decision that we made. And we need to get more young people involved, but I don't know, this things like that, assassination in Minnesota are not going to help people who are thinking about being involved in public service of any kind, city commission, county commission, school boards, not to mention state. I don't think anything that I know of, state legislatures, legislators, have come under attack like this. It's pretty sad.
We'll hope that people love their neighbor.
Yeah. Love thy neighbor. You know, we can do it. Love all that good stuff.
My guest has been Merrill Pepcorn, a long-serving, now retired member of the North Dakota Legislature and former gubernatorial candidate here in North Dakota. Merrill, it's always a pleasure.
Well, we'll keep the faith, and hope is alive, and hope must be stronger than fear.
Let me ask you a quick question, yeah. Merrill. Do we educate our middle schoolers and our high schoolers well enough on what proper civil discourse is?
That I do not know. I have been doing some substitute teaching here this last year a little bit, but the highest I got up into was fifth grade for general studies. I did some music and drama and some.
How about
some
from the state perspective, for what you know the state requires of graduates here in the state?
Well, the requirements, again, I'm not so sure of, but I know there is material out there, and I think we certainly could promote it or to provide interesting avenues, materials, and things. For example, I know the fourth graders go to, I think generally every fourth grader goes to the Capitol during fourth grade. Well, there are such things as Boy State, which gets some of the high school age people involved.
And Girl State.
And Girl State, yes. And I just think that we could do more to get younger people involved, but then they see kind of what's going on. What makes the news? The bad stuff generally makes the news. And I think that might be turning off some young people too. But I just hope there are those people out there who want to serve and for all the right purposes, right intentions.
I didn't know that when you ran for governor, you considered seeking more security.
Correct. We as candidates are not provided security during a campaign. Now,
what made you think about needing more security?
Let me back up just a little bit. At the Capitol itself, the Highway Patrol is in charge of the security of the legislators. There is a car parked at the employee entrance that we use every day, a Highway Patrol car with a patrolman. Patrolwoman, one of my best friends, was just recently promoted to sergeant in Highway Patrol. She does a wonderful job. They're in the chambers, you know, at all times. And they're my favorite form of law enforcement in the state. I love the Highway Patrol. So I called them just to, because, you know, the things that we've been talking about, even before this event of yesterday, I just know that the thought entered my mind, well, what if there was some trouble at a little campaign rally? I had several public picnics and never really anticipated anything, but the thought just entered my mind, well, if they provided it as a courtesy to candidates for governor, I would have accepted. Now, I didn't have the money to hire somebody, but just
privately.
A private security, that wasn't gonna happen. But a friend of mine is retired Highway Patrol, who is, he knows all the firearms, retired military and everything, and a super decent guy. And I just thought the idea of having Ed standing around the edge of both these circles there would be comforting or confirmed, but
were you ever threatened?
Reassuring. No.
In your service, were you ever threatened?
No. Just over the phone, but not with physical violence or anything, but just extremely agitating language.
Any of your colleagues that you were aware of have threats?
No. But I just thought, this wouldn't maybe be a bad idea to have some security out on the campaign trail. But again, didn't happen, and we had a great campaign.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Well, thanks, Craig. Yeah, you do a great job. I appreciate you having done the show for several years ago. I'm a regular listener. I appreciate the nature of your guests and how you go about doing your business.
Well, thank you.
Support for Pray Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, announcing the 2025 Bush Fellows. Meet the leaders thinking bigger and differently about what's possible for their communities in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. More information at bushfoundation.org.
Still to come on Main Street, it's Prairie Plates. We're talking food trucks and more discussion about the events this past weekend in Minnesota. Stay with us.
The FM Kicks Band presents summer big band concerts at Gooseberry Park in Moorhead on June 19th at 7 p.m., showcasing the sound of jazz for 50 years. Details at fmkicksband.com.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
That means it's time for Prairie Plates, the music we hear each and every Wednesday. And today we're taking a bite out of one of summer's tastiest trends. That's food trucks. And Rick Guillon is in our Main Street studio with our guest, Chef Paul Nimmons. He's a seasoned culinary pro who runs the popular Fargo Moorhead-based food truck, Duck Duck Goose Food Company. With his wife, Paul serves up inventive burgers, loaded fries, and crowd-pleasing nachos from a mobile kitchen that's gaining a serious local following. Paul, welcome into Prairie Plates.
Thanks for having me.
And Rick, of course, it's good to hear your voice again.
It's good to be back with you, Craig. We're talking food trucks this week. This will be a lot of fun.
It sure will be a lot of fun. So, of course, my first question is, why the name Duck Duck Goose? What inspired that, Paul? And how does it either reflect your food or your personality?
Well, we grew up in the area. I know a lot of people in Minnesota call it Duck Duck Gray Duck. You know, it's a lot of fun that we just get to play with senses, get to play with that childhood mentality of food and just have fun with it. And the name actually came from our kids.
Ah, kids are so smart. What makes running a food truck different from working in a traditional restaurant? When in my mind, I think that just the logistics must be a factor tougher than maybe in a restaurant. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's my wife, who I couldn't do this without. She's a director at the Rape and Abuse Crisis Center. I mean, she has a real job and she's allowing me to run my dream here. But, you know, working in such a tight, confined area all the time is a logistic nightmare at sometimes. And it's absolutely just pure joy most, I would say 90% of the time. Working with small refrigerators, trying to make sure you have all the product that you need for an event, and then trying to Tetris it all together and make sure that you can have everything there without running out and not being unsafe.
Have you ever gotten all ready to go to an event? Everything's packed where it belongs. Everything inside the food truck is working. You hop in the driver's seat and you turn the key and it doesn't start.
Not that yet. Knocking on wood. We were going to an event and driving down the highway and all of the studs on my tires sheared off. So we almost flipped the truck while we were driving. Luckily, we were able to pull over and be safe and got it towed and fixed in the next day, and we were up and running. But we did unfortunately have to miss that event.
Rick, it's my kind of menu. You can talk more with Chef Paul about it. We've got burgers, we got fries, we got nachos. I'm guessing you have a signature dish, Paul, that people come back for more and more?
Well, we have a few. Like, we have pad thai fries. It's a dish I developed about 10 years ago out in Washington State. It's a freshly turned curly fry. We do a dehydrated peanut butter, hoisin sauce, sriracha, bean sprouts, peanuts, and cilantro on there. And it tastes like pad thai with crispy noodles. And as the potato sits and kind of wilts a little bit, it kind of gets a little almost like a pad thai mashed potato if you let it sit long enough. But usually it doesn't last that long for people.
Paul won the 2023 Fargo Hot Dish Festival with a cabbage roll hot dish. This isn't a cabbage roll hot dish, but it is a hot dish nacho. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Basically, take a traditional style, you know, Minnesota hot dish. We spike it with queso and, you know, other seasonings, whatever, and basically put it over house-made tortilla chips, more cheese, tater tots, and then we do some pickled onions to get a little crazy, and you can get it with sriracha if you want to get spicy.
I was seeing those coming out of the window yesterday, and I was very jealous. Yeah, and then some of these burgers, Not Your Mama's Burger, the Big Kahuna Burger, Pickle and the Pig Burger, Little Goose Burger, that's probably for a child. But
you'd be surprised how many adults order a Little Goose. It's actually probably, not that I want to admit it, it's probably our number one seller.
Oh, interesting. And then explain to folks, a lot of the items are gluten-free.
Yeah. So my wife's gluten-free, and we want to really support that part of the community that is gluten-free. There's a lot more people out there than they want to admit. Everything is gluten-free. Our fryers stay gluten-free. The only thing that is not gluten-free on the truck is our buns, but we do have a very high-quality gluten-free bun available, and then we can basically make anything work that way.
We talked a little earlier about the setup in the food truck. And it's explain to folks like what all is going on in there. You have a flat top, you have some burners, you have fryers.
So when our truck is about 8 feet wide. Behind me is our triple sink for dishes. In Minnesota, we have to have a fifth sink. So we have a hand sink, a fifth prep sink. We have our triple sink there. And then basically that's at my back. In front of me is two fryers. Those are full size. I've got a 36-inch flat top and a set of two burners on top of a chef base, which is a pull-out drawer refrigerator. And then right to my left is our service cooler and on the other side of that, next to the fryer, is our little tiny freezer that we can fit two cases of French fries in. So it's a lot of different than, you know, working in a restaurant where you have almost unlimited space if you do it right.
There are some other things too, like dirt and worms, chocolate pudding. It seems like there's a little bit of a Midwestern theme here.
It's kind of a callback to, you know, childhood. It's goes with the truck, duck, duck, goose. It's playful. We do modern American with a whimsical twist. So when was the last time most people probably had a dirt and worms? When they're 7, 8 years old. So why not have that available? And, you know, it's gluten-free. It's, you know, it's a little taste of childhood.
I might have had dirt and worms at my granddaughter's last birthday party.
It's fun.
So it's more recent. It's more recent than that. I have a question, Paul. How do you plan where you're going to go? Do you ever drive up to a place and think, oh, there's already 3 food trucks here, I need to make a change? Or how do the logistics work of your planning on where you set up shop?
We run from April to October, you know, Fargo-Moorhead weather. But we start planning probably around January. We start getting phone calls and emails. And before we were even open as of April 2nd, I believe, we had, I think, 87 events already planned out.
Wow. So you know well in advance what your schedule is, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, we're already planning a few weddings for next year. So that's kind of exciting.
Where's the funnest place in Fargo you like to show up at?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. I mean, we go to Harold's a lot. And Rick, if you're ever around in Harold's or everybody here that, you know, stop by and we'll, I know you're a burger fan, so we're going to, I was hoping to get you one yesterday, but.
I was in a hurry, but I'm about 10 burgers deep in the downtown Fargo Burger Royale. There's 18 of them. And so I think I'll make it through all 18. I have through June to eat them. So, but I'll definitely be stopping at Harold's because that's a great spot in Moorhead and great cocktails there and just a fun crowd.
Yeah, but it's a super fun place.
Yeah. I think you're out at Icewind sometimes.
Yep, we'll be out on Icewind this Friday.
Mapleton.
Yep. That's usually a really fun crowd. The first time we were out at Mapleton, my mom was actually trying to help out in the truck, and it felt like all of Mapleton showed up, and it was a struggle. It was good, but it was a struggle to get everything done.
What's mom's job in the food truck?
She ended up on the till because she was going to do burger sets, which we at the time we only had the Not Your Mama's Burger, and I think there was a little bit of panic in there, and she just kind of started spinning in circles. You know, at the end of the day, we did great. I mean, she did awesome. It was her first time ever in a food truck, and she's never worked in a restaurant before, so can't blame her for the panic of 45 people waiting in line to get your food.
There are a lot of good food trucks in downtown Fargo. The best event, in my opinion, for food trucks in Fargo is the Red River Market that goes. That's like the middle of July through October. They have a lot of new things this year, but they have a lot of great food trucks, a lot of ethnic flavors too. And I think Chef Paul shows up at that event every once in a while.
We try to. I don't know if it's going to happen this year, just purely based off of our schedule already. But yeah, I would love to be out there. And also a big shout out to Heart and Soul. If listeners haven't been to Heart and Soul, go check them out. They're awesome. Chef Joe is doing an amazing job, and it's all volunteer work.
And we had Chef Joe on not too long ago, right, Craig?
We sure did, yeah. What about other communities around the state, Rick? Any places where you bumped into a food truck that you just thought, oh, this is just too good?
You know, Mabel's All Day in Bismarck is quite good. It's kind of the similar concept to Duck Duck Goose. I think Paul gets a little more creative, but Mabel's All Day is great. Little Blue Elephant out of Minot is quite good. The Wok is a Filipino food truck out of Grand Forks. That's very good, but there are a lot of food trucks out west that are quite good too, some barbecue, that sort of thing. There was just a food truck festival in Watford City, and so food trucks are very popular in North Dakota, even though we have kind of a short season here. It's just become a really popular thing, and I think it's just affordable pricing, mobile, cooking in a commercial kitchen where you're cooking for, you know, hundreds of people every night isn't appealing to everybody. So these food trucks are becoming more and more popular. And I think it's a really good thing.
Our guest has been Chef Paul Nimmons. He is the owner with his wife of Duck Duck Goose Food Company. It's a food truck that travels around Fargo. guessing that you have Facebook page, Paul, where people can figure out more about where you're at.
Yep, we got the Facebook, the Instagram. You can reach us on our website at duckduckgoosefoodcompany.com. Just wave us down. We're a giant blue bus that's covered with duck stuff and can't really miss us.
It's fun.
Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Thanks for having me, and I hope you guys have a silly day.
Main Street continues on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we continue our discussion on the events in Minnesota last weekend. Here's the latest edition of our news podcast, Prairie Beat.
This was an act of targeted political violence. Peaceful discourse is the foundation of our democracy.
Hey, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thank you for joining us this week for another edition of Prairie Beat,
our weekly discussion of headlines from the Prairie Public Newsroom. And Danielle, let's just get into it right here. We had some very serious, chilling news happen over the weekend in neighboring Minnesota that's having some ripple effects here in North Dakota and many other states across the country.
Absolutely. This story has been top of mind for most people in this region, the assassination of Minnesota's Speaker Emerita, DFL Representative Melissa Hortman, and her husband Mark in Brooklyn Park.
State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette also were gravely injured in shootings at their home in Champlin as well in this incident. Miraculously, both of them survived after being shot multiple times each.
You know, it really is just an absolutely horrific story. I was actually out of town visiting family in Minnesota when this unfolded and became glued to my phone as the initial reports came out. So I made sure to tune into the initial press briefing about it.
We don't settle our differences with violence or at gunpoint. We must all, Minnesota and across the country, stand against all forms of political violence.
Yeah, emotional remarks there from Minnesota Governor Tim Walz at that briefing. You could just really see it on his face. And at that time, the alleged perpetrator of this crime was still on the run. It was a very tense time for Minnesotans. Nobody knew exactly where this guy was. Later that day, at another briefing, authorities announced that they were looking for a man by the name of Vance Belter. And then, of course, Sunday evening, he was apprehended in a field about 45 minutes southwest of Minneapolis. He is facing multiple state and federal charges.
More details about the timeline have been revealed as well, including that between the shootings at Senator Hoffman's home and the killings at Representative Hortman's home, Acting U.S. Attorney Joe Thompson says Belter visited the homes of two other state lawmakers in the area. So that's four locations in total that they know of. He was allegedly doing all of this while dressed as a police officer, driving a vehicle that was made to appear as a police SUV, and he was wearing a silicone mask.
It is no exaggeration to say that his crimes are the stuff of nightmares. Belter stalked his victims like prey. He went to their homes, held them out as a police officer, and shot them in cold blood.
After the shootings at the Hoffmans, police were intuitive enough to do welfare checks at the homes of other lawmakers in the area. One officer actually did see the alleged gunman up the street from one of those homes, and then two other officers later met him at the home of Representative Hortman. Those officers ended up trading fire with Belter there when he allegedly shot and killed the Hortmans and their dog and escaped out the back of the home, and then, of course, kicking off that two-day manhunt.
When Governor Walz began that initial briefing, he was very direct with the language that he used. He said the killings were acts of political violence and that the murder of Speaker Hortman was an assassination. Authorities have stated that items in the car do suggest these acts were politically motivated, such as notebooks with lists of dozens of Democratic lawmakers from Minnesota as well as neighboring states.
Yeah, and curiously enough, flyers with the words "No Kings" on them also were found in the fake police vehicle. Now, at this stage of the investigation, authorities are not definitively saying what Belter's motives truly were, but those flyers did prompt Governor Walz and law enforcement to ask the public not to attend those No Kings rallies in Minnesota on Saturday, you know, out of an abundance of caution for the safety of the public, I'm sure.
Yes, and concerns for safety is understandably becoming a relevant discussion. This was a person who was working from a list, who he knew where these lawmakers lived, And that detail has a lot of people rattled. Here in North Dakota and many other places, perhaps to the surprise of many, lawmakers' emails, phone numbers, workplaces, and even home addresses are not only public knowledge, but they're posted on legislative websites.
So in the days since this event, lawmakers here are looking at that level of accessibility. The North Dakota Monitor and other sources have reported that legislative support staff have wiped legislators' home addresses from the legislature's website.
That decision was made by Executive Director for Legislative Council. His name is John Bjornson. And he said a more long-term policy will be discussed when legislative management meets next week. And last night, I did see that Governor Kelly Armstrong spoke to WDAY about this as well, saying that ultimately lawmakers do want to be accessible.
You want to be able to make sure everybody's protected without giving it as an excuse to wall off elected officials from their constituents.
Yeah, definitely we'll be watching that closely to see how lawmakers navigate this issue. Now, another thing I wanted to talk to you about, Danielle, you know, as this situation was unfolding very rapidly, you and I were texting back and forth between briefings and trying to learn about the status of the manhunt. And there was really, you know, just a lot of things I was seeing on social media about that really made me scratch my head. It was reported that the alleged shooter apparently worked for Governor Tim Walz and former Governor Mark Dayton. People saying, well, this is some kind of Democrat that did this. And then later reporting revealed that Belter was, in fact, a conservative Trump voter, a staunch anti-abortionist. His own roommate told reporters that the guy would be offended to be called a Democrat. And so it really got me thinking about something that you hear all over America, confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. You hear that in law enforcement and hiring processes and other things. It applies to this too. In this case, how that informs the way people consume their information, because as I kept looking around, I kept seeing a lot of that same narrative persist.
Well, I think what you just talked about there is the main issue, Eric, and this may be a rare time I hop up on my soapbox about something, but what you said about, you know, what you were seeing in social media, that's key. It was reported nationally just recently that more people officially are getting their news from social media than actual news sources. And when you think about it, it sort of makes sense when you bring up that confirmation bias element. You know, we all have that mm-hmm. to some degree. We all want to see and learn from places that talk to us in ways that we feel we can trust or want to be talked to. But when you have that highly emotional, politically charged event, like the one we just experienced, you know, people want to be informed. They want to be assured. And so they will land on those places that they trust. And that's when you start seeing certain narratives and ideas take shape and then end up taking hold. Now, this, of course, is all related to where people get their information. I was pretty adamant with people I was talking with over the weekend, you know, just be careful how they were discussing the case and stay out of comment sections. Don't feed into any theories you might see. When it comes to highly charged breaking news like this, it's critical to seek truth, but to also take a breath. Make sure you're looking in places that are giving straight facts. And when I say that, I mean watch the press briefings. Pay attention to the local outlets that are there asking the questions face-to-face, how they're reporting it. You know, we can't know everything all at once. I know it seems like we can just because of how fast stuff moves and gets transmitted these days. Mm-hmm. And we want to know. But primary sourcing is important. It matters. The law enforcement statements, the state government officials, what are they saying? What are they not saying? And we can only know what they've confirmed and what they haven't. Unfortunately, we just don't know what they haven't confirmed yet. Many are claiming they know why this happened, but officially, no motives have been made public.
Yeah, it reminds me of the plane crash in India and so many theories and speculations based on watching a video. And it takes like a year at least to get a final report on an investigation like that. You know, Danielle, some of the comments that I see with all these confirmation biases in these narratives, like they're on quote unquote legitimate sites and they're in the comment section. Mm-hmm. And so like, even if you present the facts, like sometimes like it just doesn't sink in. So it's not shocking to me really as a news person that you'd say what you said very eloquently, I must say, Danielle. And I think that it's natural when something like this happens in this political climate in 2025, you don't want the perpetrator to be somebody that aligns with some positions you might share. You know, we all kind of do it. Well, thank God it's the other side who owns this particular alleged shooter. That is a reaction that's been happening around the country. We'll watch for developments, of course, as the case progresses, for sure, Danielle, and we always will present and pay attention to the facts. All right, now it is time for another look. But believe it or not, there's other stuff going on in the region. So what's getting chased down by the Prairie Public News team, Danielle? What are this week's three leads?
Number one, North Dakota Health and Human Services awards opioid settlement grants to support prevention, treatment, and recovery. Number two, no new measles cases have been confirmed in the state in the last 3 weeks. Now, I mentioned this last week as well, but it bears repeating, you know, North Dakota was reported to have the highest rate of measles in the country, and we still have not had any cases in 3 weeks, so we are watching that closely.
No news is good news?
Sometimes.
I hope so.
And number three, North Dakota man charged with threatening official after email citing Minnesota shootings. Now, this is a North Dakota Monitor story. A man from St. Thomas, his name is Charles Dalzell, was charged on Monday with threatening at least one federal official in an email that referred to the Minnesota lawmaker shootings this past weekend.
Man, the times we live in these days, tough to be a public official in 2025, I would say. That's just an added dimension. I want to make sure that we mention this. The U.S. Senate is considering a rescission package. You may have heard about this, that would claw back $1.1 billion from public broadcasting. Now, that's the money that's already been appropriated that would be taken away. And it would have a direct impact on Prairie Public's bottom line. Now, you can learn more about what you can do by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org. I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
That's Danielle Webster and Eric Etheridge reflecting on the news and news coverage of last week's assassination of Minnesota State Representative Melissa Hortman. If you'd like to keep up with regional news but have little time, be sure to subscribe to Prairie Beat, wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 18th. On this date, in 1867, the Fort Ransom Military Post was established. The fort stood atop Grizzly Bear Hill, also known as the Bear's Den, which is now a ski slope near the present-day town of Fort Ransom. Grizzly bears were once numerous in the Cheyenne River Valley and not uncommon in the Pembina Hills, Red River Valley, and Turtle Mountain areas. Fur trader Alexander Henry noted that grizzly bears are to be seen in droves along the Cheyenne River. He wrote that a large grizzly was killed just a mile from his fort at Pembina and included grizzly bear pelts in his trade inventory. He added, "Near Devil's Lake, they are very common as the black bear is here, and very malicious. On the banks of the Cheyenne River, they are also very numerous and seldom molested by the hunters. So there they breed and multiply in security." Henry called the area a veritable nursery for grizzlies. John Tanner, the white captive who traded at Pembina with his native family, recalled in his autobiography that one of their hunters was killed by a grizzly on the prairie near Pembina. Another hunter was well known throughout the territory for a desperate encounter with three grizzlies on the plains west of Pembina. Henry Schoolcraft met him in Michigan and documented the story. That hunter was Little Thunder, son of Chief Old Wild Rice, who appears in the Pembina fur trade journals of both Alexander Henry and Charles Chabois. While hunting buffalo west of Pembina with a Red River cart train of Chippewa and Métis, Little Thunder was away from camp on foot when he was charged by three grizzlies, a mother and her yearlings. He managed to kill the sow, but was severely mauled. The yearlings continued to attack until he lost consciousness. A search party later found him walking back to camp, so badly shredded that they were left speechless. They summoned a priest. Expected to die within the hour, Little Thunder refused emergency baptism and last rites. According to his great-grandson, tribal historian Pat Gourneau, Catholic converts afterward feared him as a devil, a demon, a sorcerer, and a magician. He doctored himself, but the attack left him so disfigured that his appearance frightened others for the rest of his life. At age 56, Little Thunder converted to Christianity and was baptized by Joseph Gourneau. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merle Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, it's our weekly movie review with Matt Olean and Dave Thompson, and I will review this week's news of the state and the region. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you can join us again.